Feeling stressed this morning? Try this.
Try and sit up tall so you can shrug your shoulders up towards your ears as you inhale. And then exhale, go ahead, release the shoulders back down.
That moment of calm from NPR is something you might be hearing more in Illinois schools thanks to a number of mindfulness initiatives across the state. We speak with a researcher and practitioners teaching teachers to be more present. Plus, nearly 200 years ago, the Trail of Tears ran through southern Illinois. Now, how two teachers in Murfreesboro are teaching this chapter of our state's history.
A lot of them, in looking at the maps and reading the journals, recognize the areas. They may have been at a bonfire there over the weekend, or it may be part of their family farm.
But first, you may not realize it, but artificial intelligence, or AI, is in nearly everything these days. What are its potential possibilities and problems? We revisit our conversation with Microsoft researcher Eric Horvitz. It's all coming up on this Encore edition of the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For your simple needs, Siri, Alexa, any of your Google Home devices can be a great assistant. But if you ask her to add something to your calendar or to play a song, she can usually handle it. I sometimes have success. I don't know what my success ratio is with that. But imagine trying to have a full conversation with her. Researchers at Microsoft are working on ways to do that and much more. Artificial intelligence, or AI as it's called, is actually already used a lot in our lives, but it has the potential to impact us in so many other ways. Eric Horvitz is an expert in artificial intelligence. He's a director at Microsoft Research Labs. He helped start a 100-year AI study at Stanford and contributed to a new book called The Future Computed, Artificial Intelligence and Its Role in Society for Microsoft. He's with me now in our Urbana studio to tell us a little bit more about his research. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So, Eric, I think AI in pop culture, we have sort of a sense of what we think it means, right? And of course, there's even a Steven Spielberg movie called AI. And I don't know if you hate the movie Terminator and the whole idea of Skynet and AI destroying our world. But in real life, how much are we using AI or interacting with it without even realizing it?
There's an amazing amount of what I would call AI under the hood. And it's been there for a couple of decades now or even more. For example, it's amazing to understand that all of our handwritten addresses right now in the United States are zooming through a system, saving millions of dollars a year, looking at reading addresses automatically, no matter how poorly you write them.
By the Postal Service.
By the U.S. Postal Service. This has been in place since the late 90s. If you use a Windows laptop, the machine continues to learn about you privately in the privacy of your own laptop, and it's always guessing your next move, and it's pre-launching and pre-fetching to make things faster so it's there when you touch a key or launch an application, using the really nice, fun machine learning, as it's called.
So I think when some people hear that, they probably freak out. Like, that sounds a little creepy that your machine is learning a little bit about you. Can you explain a little bit more about what predictive learning is and what it's designed to do?
Well, I think concerns arise because a lot of AI these days is fueled by data, including data that we generate when we use the web, for example. So it's very important for companies like Microsoft and competitors like Google and Facebook to make sure that the data is kept private, people understand how it's being used, they buy off on it when they sign up for a service, it's deleted over time and so on, and handled very carefully. But the idea basically is we try to learn to predict, to provide, to personalize news feeds, to understand how to diagnose diseases from symptoms by looking at large data sets. So let's go back to that medical example. I've been involved with several projects where we've taken, again, with very, very strict privacy policies, large amounts of data over like 15 years of a hospital to try to understand how to build a system that can predict based on symptoms of this patient coming in the emergency room or in the hospital, what's going to happen next? What are the highest risks? What diseases are present? And you can do this with systems that learn how to pool this data into these we call predictive models that then can be applied in a personal way for a particular patient, for example. Will this patient be readmitted in 30 days after they're discharged, which is a very important a risk? And we have systems that we created that can do that kind of reasoning, pooling over a decade of data from hospital records.
And so that all falls under the rubric of AI. How do you think the layperson should think about what artificial intelligence is and what it means?
Well, back in 1956 or so, the phrase artificial intelligence, AI, was first used in terms of a proposal for a summer workshop at Dartmouth, where folks were going to get together and solve lots of problems that summer to figure out how to solve problems that were in the domain of human beings, things that required people to solve. And they talked about the challenges of understanding language, of seeing, perceiving, of planning and decision-making, and learning, adapting over time with information and observations. And so they took these pillars and they said, let's try to build a field. Now people, we look at this as looking towards a science, an actual science of intelligence, like an aerodynamics for decision-making and perception. In some ways, we're touching, and this was what people get sensitive about, we're touching up against a realm of that's been the domain or dominion of humans in terms of human intellect. We're getting better at doing things that we always thought we needed people to do.
So there's a great example of this. You gave a TEDx talk in Austin a couple of years ago, and you have an assistant at your office at
by
Microsoft.
My door.
At your door. And so how does this, before we play the interaction, is this assistant, is it just an interface that comes up when someone comes to your door, or is it just a voice that talks to you?
Oh, no. There's a beautiful or handsome, depending on the day. We use male and female. We even change skin color to not have one particular persona, but as a floating head on a little screen on a pole by my door.
Okay.
And this, it's actually, you know, it's generated to not be exactly human-like. It's kind of a little cartoony, but the system can see, hear, interact with dialogue. It knows my calendar, knows important email coming in, understands how busy I am by looking at my desktop activity and listening to my office to see if I'm chatting with somebody. And it actually works with people to schedule appointments, tell them where I might be, when I might be coming back, how to get in touch with me, takes messages. So it actually will say, well, he's not here, but you want to tell me what's up? And it'll nod his head and listen, and then let me know later.
So let's hear a little bit of an interaction. And what's the name of your assistant?
You know, we had names, but we decided to back off and say, the assistant.
Okay, so this is the assistant interacting with a Microsoft intern.
Here's Johanna.
Hi.
Are you here looking for Eric?
Yep.
Eric is talking with someone.
I can see that.
And this might take a while.
Oh.
But I don't think he'd mind a brief interruption right now. Okay. You could check back in 15 minutes or so, and we could see if he's available then.
Okay.
So what we don't get for that, we'll tweet out the link so everyone can watch the video, because there's these priceless expressions that she has on her face when she's interacting with your assistant, where the look of horror on her face when she says, oh, you can interrupt him now. You can very clearly, like, she's just like, I don't want to do that. That to me is an interesting example, though, of the way that we're relating to all. So there's sort of like the human side of this, and then there's the machine side of this. How do you think our lives have adapted? I'm even thinking of just even all the connected home devices that we've seen in the past couple of months. Like, I realize I've adapted my language to talk to Alexa, because when I'm talking to her, if I speak like a normal person, she won't understand me.
You know, the part of the technology and the push is to make these interfaces more natural. Even today, that's several years old. The assistant by my door, we've worked really hard, in fact, with some great interns that have joined us to make her more natural, or him more natural, in terms of facial expressions, understanding the nuances of conversation. So the technology, I think, will come a long way over time to join us and be more natural over time. People can expect, I think, over the next 5 to 7 years or so, for these devices, you know, whether it be the Cortana or Siri, Alexa, to start having more natural conversations that actually go beyond command, like set timer or next meeting, more like talking about the weather and getting to the airport on time, and the way we talk to friends and colleagues, multiple topics popping and pushing, as we call them, on a stack in a natural way. We will be having actual fluid conversations with intelligences that are here to support us in various ways. And some will be very much like personal butlers.
I'm speaking with Eric Horvitz. He's a technical fellow and he's the director at Microsoft Research Labs. And when we think about that, it's a couple years old now, an incident with a bot that Microsoft created, Tay, that was released out onto the world via Twitter. And for people who don't know, like in less than 24 hours after her arrival on Twitter, she had gained more than 50,000 followers. And the problem was she started mimicking their language and voicing some fairly awful sentiments about Nazi sympathies and anti-female language, just bad language in general. And I wonder, would you consider that artificial intelligence? What did you all learn from that at Microsoft in terms of how this, the interplay will happen between people and machines?
Well, let me first say that that system in particular wasn't a deep piece of AI. It was largely a rule-based powered system, but that doesn't mean the learnings, the teachings don't go deep for AI systems or any advanced technology we put out into the world to interact with people and society more broadly in terms of being very careful at thinking deeply through a technology and its influences, being very humble about the complex admixture of when you add human beings to a technology. You really can't predict how it's going to go sometimes. You have to watch carefully. You have to be able to pull back, modify, refine technology. At Microsoft, about a year ago, we created a committee called Ether. It stands for AI and Ethics in Engineering and Research. It has a set of subcommittees that span all the way from how do we think about sensitive uses of AI, like visual recognition, facial recognition systems in sensitive areas like criminal justice and policing? How do we think about biases that might show up in these systems when they're used to give advice, when the data sets they learn from might be biased in terms of race and gender, in particular, you know, poor representation of minorities in those systems, among other challenges? And then can we build safe, robust or trustworthy systems that can explain themselves to people, that people will come to trust because for good reasons? You know, I'm one of the rare AI aficionados that's been in a Tesla autopilot accident, you know, where my own car hit something that it shouldn't have hit while I was on the phone, after I came to trust it over a period of months on the same street. These are really interesting issues as we build and field technologies that will come into our lives, especially in areas that are safety critical, like healthcare, transportation.
So what kind of things are you telling the students, the future engineers of today? I'm fascinated by what I can't imagine what's going on at the University of Illinois in terms of engineering and computer science, certainly a lot of cutting edge research. What kind of things are you telling the engineers who are learning all of this now?
I am inspired by this area. I think this technology is going to have so many impressive and deep benefits to humanity. Agriculture. We have systems now that can help farmers to do precision agriculture, to understand their soils, that can watch over and fuse information and make predictions as to even, you know, when to sow crops, given many different feeds coming in. Healthcare. Accessibility. I think that I've just been so impressed with some technologies that we've been able to feel, just even though they're preliminary, that help people who are sight impaired to see better. Now, at the same time, after we go through the positives, I like to sort of say, let's take a deep breath and step back and always consider the possible rough edges that might come along.
And as we think about that, Eric, I'm just wondering in terms of as we're thinking about all of this technology, you mentioned something about news feeds. Certainly that's been part of the conversation about how we get our news. There's technology that exists out there now where you can actually even just use facial recognition and create complete fake news of, like, it looks like the president is saying something they're not. So for people who are worried about all of those counters, how are technology companies like Microsoft trying to work against that?
Stepping back again, you know, would we give up fire as humanity, even though it's being applied in cruel and unsurprising ways? We still have the world of civilization, electricity and machines. Technologies are fairly neutral. We have to worry about criminal uses of AI, just like we have to worry about criminal uses of anything or malevolent usages. I and my wife funded, and we endowed Stanford about 6 years ago or so, 5 years ago now, on a study called the 100-Year Study of Artificial Intelligence. If you go to that website, ai100.stanford.edu, you can read a framing memo we created with 18 areas of concern. Now, one of those areas of concern we called AI democracy and freedom. Could these systems, these precision reasoning systems that learn from data, learn how to manipulate human minds, whether it be through creating new kinds of imagery, as you suggested, which can be done now, or through just understanding what to say to you over time, over weeks or months from multiple aspects of your life, to shift your beliefs, to obfuscate something, to make you think differently. We have evidence now that's possible. I would like to raise our awareness of this possibility and then think through what might best protect people, what might best protect our individuality, our independence of thought, our democracy, or democracies across the world, when malevolent uses of AI could be powerful and could be manipulative.
Lots to think about. We will tweet out those links that Eric mentioned if you're interested in learning a little bit more about it. Eric Horvitz is a technical fellow and director at Microsoft Research Labs in town. Thanks for being with me, Eric. I appreciate it.
It was fun talking to you.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Studies MillerCom 18 Lecture Series presenting Toward a Manifesto for Diverse Psychological Science, March 26th at 4 p.m. at Beckman Institute. Professor of Psychology Enrique Neblet will discuss incorporating diversity and the human experience into psychological science. cas.illinois.edu.
Back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. According to the National Institutes of Health, more than 18 million Americans are meditating and engaging in mindfulness on a regular practice. So it shouldn't be surprising to hear that our youngest Americans, children, are getting in on the practice too. There's growing scientific evidence behind mindfulness and the benefits of meditation, including a renewed sense of focus, stress and anxiety management, not to mention coping with trauma and physical health benefits like lowering your blood pressure. And how schools are looking at this issue is what we're going to talk about now. Schools in Illinois have an incentive to this. 2 years ago, Senate Bill 100 gave districts a year to ban zero-tolerance disciplinary policies and investigate other intentions as well. So how mindfulness can be a preventative tool for disciplinary measures is another issue. Joining me now are two mindfulness educators who work with teachers and students. They're working particularly in the Urbana-Champaign area. Jason Scott is the president of the Mindful Teacher Foundation. Mia Donovan is one of the foundation's instructors. Both of them are here with me in our Urbana studio. Hi, welcome to
Hello.
The 21st.
Thank you for having us.
On the line from Chicago, I'm joined by Amanda Moreno. She's an assistant professor at the Erickson Institution. Amanda's in the middle of a multi-year study on mindfulness practices at Chicago Public Schools classrooms, the first of its kind, looking at elementary students in high poverty areas. Amanda, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me. Sorry I couldn't be there in the studio with you.
But that's okay.
For the discussion.
Jason, so mindfulness is a word we hear a lot now.
Right.
What does it mean, and particularly when you're talking about kids in a classroom?
Right. So mindfulness is a particular way of paying attention, a deliberate way of paying attention. Specifically to what's arising in the present moment in your sensory experience. So if you think about the five senses, what you feel in the body, what you hear, see, taste, etc. And it's doing so with an attitude of openness and curiosity to whatever is coming up, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant.
Mia, how do you explain that to kids?
We like to begin with an experience of mindfulness with kids. So we engage them in a listening practice with a chime or some sort of percussion instrument, and encourage them to focus all their attention, their hearts and their minds on the sound. And we also begin with a mindful eating practice in which they eat a piece of fruit mindfully. So you,
and so what does that mean when you say they're eating a piece of fruit mindfully?
So, you know, they have an apple in front of them and we ask them, what do you see? What colors do you see? And they'll say, you know, red. Well, what else do you see? And then we sort of encourage them to look very closely and notice all the different colors they see. And then we, you know, bring the apple to our nose. What do we smell? See if we can describe that without using the word apple. And then we slowly take a bite and without chewing, move the apple piece around in our mouth. And kids love this. It really engages them. So we're using our five senses. And then after we've allowed them to experience a mindfulness practice, we explain that mindfulness is paying attention here and now with kindness and curiosity. And so they usually respond pretty well to that.
Amanda, what made you want to research mindfulness? Was this something that you practiced?
No, I did not come to this world through having my own mindfulness practice or being a yoga practitioner or anything like that. I came to it as a researcher from the discovery that a lot of the programs that had been trying to sort of access and help improve some of these kind of self-regulation skills in kids weren't working. And I don't know exactly why that is, but my idea about why that might be has something to do with the difference between thinking and feeling. And it seemed to me that mindfulness has this unique power in helping to kind of reach kids through a more visceral, kind of sensory, guttural level first, without sort of trying to get them to, you know, access the highest levels of their cognition all the time. So the way this might look in like a traditional, like social emotional type of program that does not use the mindfulness approach, for example, is they might say something like, you know, next time you have a fight with your friend on the playground, what would you do differently? And those are important skills, but it's hard to kind of start there, right? You're asking kids to project themselves into the future, and that's really a high-level cognitive skill. Whereas by focusing on the present moment, by focusing on your breath, by focusing on how does this feel right now in this moment, getting kids to slow down first, it gets them to actually feel it first, which then sort of opens them up a little bit to be able to start thinking about those more future-oriented processes.
That's Amanda Marino. She's an assistant professor at the Erickson Institute on the line from Chicago talking to us about this. Jason Scott, the Mindful Teacher Foundation is working in Unit 4 schools and the Urbana School District. So in Urbana-Champaign, K through 12, when did that program start and what are you specifically doing?
Well, we are right now in the middle of our third year of programming, and we have a course called Mindful Teacher, Mindful Kids. And this is offered through the professional development programs of both districts, so teachers can sign up to participate. And it's offered, it's a 24-hour course, 24 instructional hours that's offered over the course of the entire year. So we have about 19 sessions that that participants complete. And the first half is really just about the core mindfulness skills, so learning how to do the practice for yourself. And in the second half of the program, we provide teachers with different resources and strategies and materials that they can use to bring mindfulness into the classroom.
And so, Amanda, while these things that Jason's talking about, these techniques, are things that have been used for centuries, the research supporting this is somewhat new, and I wanted to ask you about that. The University of Chicago Crime Lab has been studying the effects of meditation and quiet time in partnership with the David Lynch Foundation. Your study is a 5-year program with some funding from the Department of Education. You mentioned something earlier. What do we know about mindfulness and how it helps, particularly as you're talking about what you're looking at elementary students in high poverty areas. You're talking about conflict resolution. What do we know now?
There is actually a lot we know so far. We don't really know why mindfulness works. You know, I provided some ideas earlier about why that would be. But I would say we know pretty well that it is effective at the outcomes that researchers have been looking at. They've been looking at things like social-emotional skills, self-regulation skills, executive function, which is kind of the more cognitive version of self-regulation skills, and even into academics. So, for example, Goldie Hawn has a mindfulness program called Mind Up, and that has, you know, a gold standard randomized controlled trial associated with it, showing that the program even helps kids, you know, into their academic skills. So, you know, relative to a lot of other, you know, educational research, which is always messy and complicated and difficult, I would say that mindfulness is right in there as far as showing a lot of promise for being a good tool to add to the repertoire. So it's not to say that we would throw out the other things. It's not to say that we wouldn't do some more cerebral types of social and emotional work as well. But mindfulness seems to have a special kind of power to it that gives a little bit of structure and format and sort of public acceptance of taking a pause and taking a breath that seems to be really effective for kids.
And so,
for example, you could – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say you could think about like an anxious child, for example. Like often we think of a disruptive child first, but if you think of the anxious child who – you know, they're not being disruptive. They're just sitting there being nervous. You could imagine that knowing that a mindfulness exercise was going to be coming up pretty soon because their teacher endorses that and agrees with that and encourages it, that would be somewhat reassuring to them. They know that they're going to get that, you know, coming up pretty soon.
And so in terms of your research, Amanda, you decided to focus on certain CPS, Chicago Public School, high poverty areas on the South and West Side. Some of these children are more at risk to being exposed to long-term stress. Certainly when we talk about gun violence and the traumatic effects of that in certain communities, I don't know if you have any statistical evidence yet. It sounds like I know you're at the beginning of this, but what ways have you also seen mindful and calming techniques be effective in these circumstances?
Well, I've definitely seen it up close and personal. I mean, I've been in school buildings, my staff have been in school buildings right in the middle of a lockdown because there's been a shooting down the block. You know, I don't want to overpromise and say that a mindfulness technique cures that problem by any means. Of course, we need social justice initiatives to be keeping going, you know, right alongside all this work. But certainly, again, knowing that there's this idea that in this community, it's okay. It's okay to feel what you're feeling. It's okay to take a pause from our academic work and just feel our breath and get calm together and you know, process these feelings, whether they're bad or good. I've definitely seen it have a positive impact. And I've also noticed in our work that we do with parents that parents, you know, intuitively seem to understand this, and in fact, they crave more of it. So they say to us, wow, I really need this. So all the normal stresses of life are happening in terms of homework and bedtime. But of course, when you live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of poverty, a lot of violence, you know, even the daily normal stressors become that much more difficult. And it looks like mindfulness has a lot of promise for, you know, taking that edge off and allowing the coping to begin.
Mia, so that's Amanda's perspective for Chicago and for CPS. What are you seeing with teachers and with parents? Well, Amanda was mentioning parents and children. What are you seeing in the Urbana-Champaign area in terms of what are you hearing from people about how it's helping their student population?
We've had a lot of positive response from the teachers who have been in our program, who've gone through our course, for themselves, not only for their students, but for themselves. And actually, as Jason mentioned, the first part of our course, we really focus on the teachers because a teacher is in the classroom and there's so much going on in there. So many students requiring their attention. They're trying to teach a lesson and then there's distractions going on. And so if the teacher herself or himself can be in a mindful place, they are able to better able to respond to the students' needs and create a classroom community that's positive for those students. And then for kids, kids seem to really enjoy mindfulness practices. They seem to kind of respond very naturally. It's sort of a natural state for them to be enjoying the moment. And so, building on that, I think is really, there's an opportunity for that.
Jason, to that point, is it different to teach mindfulness to, so when you're teaching teachers, how do you have the teachers teach students? Is it different depending on what age you're at, the way that you're talking about these techniques?
And this was something that we learned very early on as we were implementing the program, was that because we're working with such a broad range of teachers in the context, specific context that they're working within. So we have teachers from across the K-12 spectrum, so kindergarten teachers and high school teachers. We have counselors and social workers and school psychologists, even librarians and administrators. So how each of these educators is going to work with mindfulness in their specific context with the kinds of students and the needs that they're addressing is going to be very different, which is why we went from, say, teaching a curriculum to really teaching a collection of different strategies that can be applied. Because some teachers might just want a 3-minute mindfulness exercise that they can do after lunch or after, after PE or recess. And others, we had some counselors who were interested in putting together an after-school program, so wanting a more in-depth curriculum that they could apply.
We just have a minute or two left, so Jason, I wanted to ask you really quickly. We were just talking about school funding earlier in the show. Some people might hear about programs like this and think meditation, that sounds like a luxury.
Right.
What's your response to that?
Well, it was our strategy early on, especially when we got started, and there was not a whole lot of awareness about mindfulness. So we structured the Mindful Teacher Foundation as a nonprofit entity. So what we do is a large part of activity is raising funds to offer these programs free of charge to the districts. And so right now, in our first year, we were funded by a grant from the Illinois Children's Healthcare Foundation. And at this point, our programs are sustained by donors. So people within the community, people and businesses within the community are providing the funding that we need to implement these programs.
Amanda, what about you? As I said, we just have about a minute left, but when you're thinking about CPS and the investment in mindfulness, why do you think that it's an important thing?
Well, I have to say, we're actually pretty lucky with CPS, despite all the budget craziness and the difficulties that have happened in the district. They've maintained their social-emotional learning as a priority, and they've allowed the Calm Classroom program and our project, into the doors to be able to do that. Now, of course, we did bring in some external funding, for the research part of it. But in terms of ongoing, it seems that they're maintaining this as a priority, that schools need to have some kind of social and emotional approach. Just like they need to have a math curriculum and a literacy curriculum, they need to have this. And so we're just grateful that, that the mindfulness angle on that has been, allowed into the door and seems to be taking hold.
That's Amanda Moreno. I want to thank her. She's at the Erickson Institute, and she's in the middle of a multi-year study, the first of its kind, looking at elementary students in high-poverty areas studying mindfulness practices at Chicago Public Schools. I also want to thank Jason Scott with the Mindful Teacher Foundation. They're working in the Urbana-Champaign School District area, and Mia Donovan, who also is with the Mindful Teacher Foundation. All of you, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. When Native Americans in the southeastern United States were removed from their homes in the 1830s, they were forced to march west for hundreds of miles in what's now known as the Trail of Tears. You may have heard us mention on The 21st before that part of that path actually ran through southern Illinois. Last summer, three Trail of Tears sites were added to the National Register of Historic Places. Now, local educators are taking that history to the classroom. Two high school teachers in southern Illinois have developed a special curriculum about local history in collaboration with SIU and are using it in their history classrooms. So how do you teach this chapter of Illinois history? I'm joined now by two Murfreesboro High School history teachers behind the class, Stacy Taft and Rachel Bocci. Both teach at Murfreesboro High School. They developed this curriculum as part of a master's program at SIU. Also joining us is Kaylee Sharp. She's a board member with the Illinois chapter of the Trail of Tears Association. Stacy, Rachel, Kaylee, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stacy, let's start with you. As I mentioned, you're a history teacher at Murfreesboro High School. When we're thinking about teaching this chapter in American history and Illinois history, what are some of the most important details about the Trail of Tears that you want your students to know?
I think one of the most important aspects of this is allowing the students to analyze what was going on and why it was going on, and not just look at it as it's just a piece of history you read in a book, to realize that these were people and this was a culture, and there were reasons behind the decisions they made. There were reasons they stayed at this particular campsite, and that there were horrific conditions, both and some good conditions and some good situations that they experienced in southern Illinois, but that to make a personal connection, not only with the curriculum, but with the significance of the event.
Rachel, as someone who's not a history teacher, I wonder how hard it is to teach tragedies, because when you're talking about painful events that happened in our past, I think to back to the days when I was a high school student, whether it's anything that happened more than 10 years ago just seems very remote, right? So I wonder, for this particular class, how do you make sure that history comes alive for these students, especially since this is something that is happening, that did happen in their, in, you know, very close to them?
Yes, I think that's one of the main reasons that I wanted to become a history teacher in general, was just to kind of make it come alive in a lot of ways. I think it's important that we look at history, and especially this history, as Stacy said, from these different perspectives, and understanding that there's so many sides and versions of history, and that we usually just get one version, and it's usually the most boring version, and we don't want to talk about anything bad or like get into all the details of some of the horrific things that have happened in our past, especially in U.S. history, that we kind of whitewash it, and we just like to talk about it minimally, especially the Trail of Tears in our textbooks is just briefly mentioned. So the fact that we're digging in deeper and looking at it as, you know, the history in our own backyard, and kind of looking at it from their culture, understanding better about what they actually went through, why they went on the routes that they did, why they were forced to leave, why they ended up where they did, and just looking at some primary sources. I really think that makes it come alive in a lot of instances, getting out of the book and understanding from women and minorities and different people on all kinds of topics, kind of their perspective, and it kind of brings a whole new history alive. So we're hoping with the Trail of Tears to do that and look at it in a way that people haven't done before.
Stacy, Rachel mentioned primary sources. What primary sources are you all using?
For this particular curriculum, we're using Buttrick's Journal, who was a minister that accompanied the Cherokee through southern Illinois, and then thanks to Ms. Kaylee Sharp, who has used that journal to create our GIS maps that then show where mills were, where taverns were, where there were water sources, and we collaborate that with the diary entries and try to determine, okay, so why did they stop here? Did they stop here because the culture was friendly, or did they stop here because they had food and water sources? Why did they stay in this particular place so long? How come on this day they traveled 1 mile and on this day they only went a tenth of a mile? What's the journal say about the weather? Determining the why these decisions were made and what impact it had on their journey through southern Illinois.
Kaylee, I wanted to bring you into the conversation. Stacy mentioned maps. You're a board member with the Illinois chapter of the Trail of Tears Association. You all actually presented Stacy and Rachel with an award for their work. Before we get to why you think this course is significant, I just wanted to understand a little bit more about the mapping you did. How did you help them out with that?
In 2012, I carried out a research project with Dr. Mark Wagner of the Center for Archaeological Investigations, in which we kind of delved through the historical data and information records on the Trail of Tears and associated events that happened in 1838 and 1839. So that was developed a number of years ago, and I was able to provide that information not only in my capacity as a researcher, but also as a member of our local chapter of the Trail of Tears Association to provide them with accurate and detailed information that really isn't available online or in history books. So,
yeah, and then so when we look at the map of the route, Stacy, can you remind us where the route went? You guys are in Murfreesboro, where you're about 15 minutes west of Carbondale. How close did they come to where you guys are?
Our district lines are, the closest part of the route that came to us would have been through Union County, down in the Mississippi bottoms next to the Mississippi River, which is probably, some of our kids live in that area. So a connection that they've had with this because of that is they could be like, I recognize this. This is my grandpa's farm, you know. So we are within 10 miles of some of the sites as far, and then as far away as Polk County, which is in more southeastern Illinois.
And Rachel, do we know how the Trail of Tears actually ended up in southern Illinois? Do we know a little bit more about why the Trail of Tears sort of veered through the southern part of our state?
I am not 100% sure. That was something I actually wanted to do some more research on, because the routes that we looked at were not the most direct routes to where they wanted them to end up. And so the fact that it did come up through southern Illinois, we looked at four different routes. We focused on the one that came through southern Illinois, and that's the one we tracked. But as far as really understanding why they came that way specifically, I don't know exactly. Now, Stacy or Kaylee might know.
Yeah, Kaylee,
more.
I wonder with your research with the Trail of Tears Association, do we have an answer to that?
We have a number of answers, specifically why it came through the 60-mile stretch through Polk, Union, and Johnson counties in southern Illinois. There are geographical aspects that certainly contributed to that, but there were both northern and southern routes. A part of the reason that it did travel through southern Illinois has to do with the confluence of the rivers that were leading to the Mississippi. They had to get across them. And so apart from the river routes that bound the southern areas of Illinois as a state, that was a part of the reason why they came through southern Illinois as well. So because they were not traveling on the river routes, they were more expensive in some regards. So, and we had established routes at that point in time leading to the western U.S. So not necessarily the most convenient, but certainly a route that was accessible to them. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that's how a lot of history happens, right? It doesn't happen in a way that would make sense to us when we look back on it. Stacy, can I ask something? Rachel said she, one of the reasons she wanted to become a history teacher was because she wanted to make history come alive. I wanted to ask you about when you first learned about the Trail of Tears coming through southern Illinois and what motivated you to develop this curriculum.
Well, the specific Trail of Tears, I had always been aware that it came through southern Illinois through my undergraduate work way back in the 90s at SIU. But my love of Native American history has really been through my childhood. I grew up in central Illinois. My grandparents' farm bordered Dixon Mounds in Lewistown, Illinois. So a lot of my love and interest in this came from just talking to my grandparents and being part of that culture with them. And then it's just, I've been fortunate enough to carry it this far.
Rachel, is this course that you all developed something that other schools can emulate?
Yes, we're going to have it accessible online. We already have something going using primary sources where they can actually use the maps. They can turn on and off the different layers that Kaylee's created. So that way, if you have those primary sources or textbooks and other things that you're using with it, the kids can actually see it. And you could actually pull this stuff up on your, you know, computer and really ask questions using the maps, so they can kind of critically think that way and compare and contrast different routes and some, even some of the questions you asked us, why do you think they came this way, you know, and kind of get them thinking deeper on the topic. But, yeah, the whole goal of making it was making it accessible for other people to use, since so many times in our graduate work we develop these things, but then people don't know about it or they're not able to find it or use it. So we've been doing this with multiple primary sources on all kinds of topics, but this one being the most recent one that is accessible on our website.
And SIU has a link with teaching resources. We will tweet that out from our handle at 21STShow, and it will be at our 21stShow.org website as well. Kaylee, can I ask you why the Trail of Tears Association, it's so important to you all that this history is specifically taught in public schools in Illinois?
Well, it's certainly a very important part of U.S. history. The Trail of Tears affected not only the Cherokee people, the 13,000 Cherokee people who traveled through southern Illinois, but also a number of other groups that were relocated as a result of the Indian Removal Act. And certainly this is a part of history that remains very much alive for a number of Native American populations today. And it is certainly a part of our history that mustn't be forgotten. It's a tragic story, but it's also a success story. And so it's very important, the work that Rachel and Stacy have done for us to continue that, to help our young people know more about that history and the complexities of that history, because these stories are never direct. So as a part of our mission through the Trail of Tears Association, one of our key missions is to promote awareness of this historical legacy. And so it's remarkable what they have accomplished.
Rachel, when we're thinking about these documents and how they make history the more real for students, how have students responded to what you guys have done?
They've really enjoyed it. I really think that anytime they can get outside of the textbook and start to analyze and put their own thoughts and support them and, you know, bring evidence from pictures or maps or just different sources and really kind of maybe question what their textbook had to say or what previous teachers have had to say. Not saying that it's wrong, but understanding that there is many other voices that they can start to bring alive as they pull out evidence from other sources and other topics on all kinds of topics. But from what we've done with it so far, implementing it, and Stacy's done more with it, but they seem to really enjoy it. And it really, some of the kids that don't normally perform as well, this is easier for them, and it's really showing some of their strengths. And then some of the kids who are more just like the memorization that came with, you know, the traditional way of teaching history are kind of struggling at first, thinking outside the box with this. But I think as they do it more, they're getting much better at it, and they're starting to enjoy it even more as well.
Stacy, you know, we have just left a minute left, but I wonder if you could just quickly share how students have responded when you've taught this.
The response has been surprising, actually. Like Rachel said, a lot of our struggling learners are really taking this and running with it, because I think part of that is by telling them that there is more than one perspective on history and there is more than one perspective on an issue, and that you don't have one right answer to any part of history, gives them the freedom to explore and analyze what's going on. Sorry, change of classes. and that helps the students to understand and start having these conversations. And I think the more we can have these conversations in a historical context, it allows them to build the skills to have a conversation that will make them more civic-minded and hopefully be able to have those conversations in an evidence-based way where they can carry this into their future citizenship and
Thanks for that. Yeah. So Murfreesboro High School teachers, that's Stacey Taft. I want to thank Rachel Bocci and Kaylee Sharp as well with the Illinois Trail of Tears Association for this curriculum. That is all at our website. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but you can head to 21stshow.org for more of those resources. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day.